Daniel, Chapter 2. The fourth talk in a series on Daniel was presented by David Crabtree on May 10, 2020, at Reformation Fellowship. The copyright for this recording is held by David Crabtree and is being made available to you by Gutenberg College. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. Contributions to David Crabtree may be made at www.soundinterp.wordpress.com. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction. All other rights reserved.
Hi, everyone. This is Welcome to Reformation Fellowship, the quarantine edition. First of all, I'd like to wish everyone a happy Mother's Day. There's been a lot of talk recently about what are essential services, and people make various judgments as to what services are essential, and some of those decisions seem to be a little bit arbitrary to me. But there is one job that is critical to any society, and that is the raising of children. And the lion's share of that falls to mothers. So there is a sense in which it seems to me that mothers have the most essential job that we have. And so I'd like to thank all of those mothers for all that you do. It's extremely important to us as individuals and to us as a society. So happy Mother's Day. Last week we looked at chapter 1 of Daniel, and I noticed that in my notes, the first point that I had written out, I had drafted that months ago, and I changed my mind since that was written, and what I presented last week is my current understanding. So what happened last week is that Daniel was taken into exile into Babylon, and he was selected to be part of a training program for young men to be trained, to be equipped to be in the service of the state in Babylon. And Daniel found himself in a situation where he felt that it was critical that he mark the holiday of Passover by fasting, because Passover is about the Exodus and the joyous coming out from slavery in Egypt. And now, under his circumstances, he has gone into exile, gone into slavery, this time in Babylon. And so he wanted to mark Passover as an anti-Passover, and so with mourning rather than with celebration. And he wanted to mark it by fasting, and his fasting was to not eat celebratory foods. So he wanted to eat vegetables and drink water rather than eating meat and drinking wine. But he ran the risk of offending the king of Babylon, who had, under his auspices, he had been selected to be part of this training program, which was a great privilege. So he ran a great risk by going against the king's instructions. It was a deal that he worked out with his guard, and the guard was concerned that the change in diet would be reflected in the health of Daniel and his three comrades. But they ran a test run for 10 days, and it didn't affect their health badly. In fact, they did well, and he was allowed to continue that. So God made it possible for this exception to be made, and Daniel to mark the Passover the way that he felt that it needed to be marked in those circumstances and not offend the king. And what's important there is Daniel is fully in solidarity with the people of Judah and the people of God. And he wanted that to make sure that he could be fully in solidarity with them. Chapter 1, as I pointed out last week, is both an introduction to the book, but is also kind of separate from the rest of the book. It is a piece in and of itself. And it starts the two major themes that we see here. One is, what does it mean for an individual to live in a culture that does not value God and what God values? And we saw a little bit of that last week. And then the other issue is the clash between empire and God. And again, just a hint of that last week. We'll see more of that this week. Starting in chapter 2, verses 1 through 3. In the second year of his reign, Nebuchadnezzar had dreams. His mind was troubled, and he could not sleep. So the king summoned the magicians, enchanters, sorcerers, and astrologers to tell him what he had dreamed. When they came in and stood before the king, he said to them, "I have a dream that troubles me, and I want to know what it means." Nebuchadnezzar became the king of Babylon in 605, as best that can be calculated. He was the son of the previous king, Nabonidus. He had been probably the most significant general under Nabonidus prior to becoming king. But in 605, he became king. That's the same year in which he took tribute and exiles out of Jerusalem and took them back to Babylon, and Daniel was included in that group. This event in chapter 2 is the second year of his reign. So this is 1 year after he became king. It's 1 year after Daniel arrived in Babylon. Now, I mentioned last week that if the Persian example, the Persians come after the Babylonians, if the Persian practice is what the Babylonians also did, the Persians had a training program. They took young people at the age of 14 and trained them for 3 years. If that were the case, if that held true in Babylonian culture, Daniel would be about 15 years old when this is happening. As we'll see as we go through this chapter, it really appears to me that the actions of Daniel as depicted in this chapter are the actions of someone who's a little more mature than 15. So that might not be the case, but I don't really know. Daniel is 1 year into his training program at this point. Notice that at the end of chapter 1, it talks about Daniel being made the ruler over all of Babylon and being wiser than all the other wise men, being tested by Nebuchadnezzar, etc., etc. I think that what it's talking about there at the end of chapter 1 probably came after the events of chapter 2. In fact, I think those probably came at the end of the training program. Chapter 2, the events here happened during the training program, while they were in the middle of the training program. What happened here? The thing that launches the events that we're going to talk about is Nebuchadnezzar had dreams. The Babylonians put great value in their dreams and their omens and reading the omens, interpreting the dreams. There was a whole class of people. There were a whole array of experts that were devoted to the occult sciences, the sciences of the unseen. And this would have fallen into that category. Nebuchadnezzar had a dream. That's significant. In fact, it says he had dreams, plural. Apparently, he had more than one, suggesting that Nebuchadnezzar is probably thinking a god is trying to communicate with me, and that's significant. He wants to pay attention to that. It also says that his mind was troubled and he could not sleep. So Nebuchadnezzar is worried. There's something concerning. Now, it could be just a dream that he doesn't understand, or dreams, plural, that he doesn't understand, and he wants to know what those are. But Nebuchadnezzar had reason to be worried. In general, in the ancient world, and even into much more modern times, when a king comes to power, that was the most precarious time in their reign, because it was known that when they first came to power, it would take time for them to get used to their position, to get the right people in the right positions, and all that sort of thing. That transition always took some time. And during that time, a king was particularly vulnerable. And everyone knew that. So when a king first came to power, things were a little tenuous, and there were often little plots that were at least being discussed about what might be done to overthrow the king. Secondly, we know historically that after Nebuchadnezzar went back from Palestine and Lebanon with Daniel and the exiles and with the tribute, after that happened, there were some uprisings in Palestine and in Lebanon. And so this was, things were a little precarious. And when things get a little precarious in the hinterlands, then there are people in the capital oftentimes who begin to see that as a sign of weakness on the part of the king, and could do something to take advantage of that weakness. As I understand it, in Babylonian times, it was considered a bad sign to have a dream and to not remember it. Now, it is not clear anywhere in this passage, as far as I can tell, whether Nebuchadnezzar truly could not understand the dream that he had had, or whether he did remember it, but he wants the wise men to tell him what it was so that he could check them out. It's not clear to me which of those is the case. I'm suspecting that it was the latter, that he did remember at least more or less. Certainly, he remembers enough that he will be able to tell whether someone knows what the dream was or not. So there are probably several reasons why Nebuchadnezzar is nervous at this particular point in time, why he's troubled. And if there were any divine guidance being provided, Nebuchadnezzar really wants to have it. So Nebuchadnezzar calls in an army of experts in the occult sciences. He brings in all of these specialists that he has available to them to help him to figure out what his dream was and what it means, more importantly, what it means. In this passage, rather than using one term, the wise men could have been a term, or the Chaldeans could have been a term that would be used here, he gives a list. He lists its magicians, enchanters, sorcerers, astrologers. So he gives a whole list of the different areas of expertise that these wise men had. This is a technique that Daniel uses in chapter 3 on a couple of occasions, and he uses it some other places in the book as well. He lists these things in order to kind of pile on, to emphasize that there were a whole array of these wise men, all kinds of wise men, just and not just one or two. There were several wise men that came in, that were called to appear before them. So Nebuchadnezzar is pulling out all the stops to try to figure out what this dream means and what he needs to learn from it. So in the context, what we'll see is that we've got this army of wise men, army of experts, that are all, in a sense, pitted against Daniel standing alone. Verse 4 through 13. Then the astrologers answered the king in Aramaic, "O king, live forever. Tell your servants the dream, and we will interpret it." The king replied to the astrologers, "This is what I have firmly decided. If you do not tell me what my dream was and interpret it, I will have you cut into pieces and your houses turned into piles of rubble. But if you tell me the dream and explain it, you'll receive from me gifts and rewards and great honor. So tell me the dream and interpret it for me." Once more they replied, "Let the king tell his servants the dream, and we will interpret it." Then the king answered, "I am certain that you are trying to gain time, because you realize that this is what I have firmly decided. If you do not tell me the dream, there is just one penalty for you. You have conspired to tell me misleading and wicked things, hoping the situation will change. So then, tell me the dream, and I will know that you can interpret it for me." The astrologers answered the king, "There is not a man on earth who can do what the king asks. No king, however great and mighty, has ever asked such a thing of any magician or enchanter or astrologer. What the king asks is too difficult. No one can reveal it to the king except the gods, and they do not live among men." This made the king so angry and furious that he ordered the execution of all the wise men of Babylon. So the decree was issued to put the wise men to death, and men were sent to look for Daniel and his friends to put them to death. So here's the story, here's the situation. It is told in Aramaic, and I mentioned this in the introduction the first week, I believe, that part of Daniel is written in Hebrew and part of it is written in Aramaic. The first chapter is written in Hebrew, and the first few words of chapter two, first few verses of chapter two are written in Hebrew. But then here in verse four, it switches into Aramaic when the astrologers respond to the king, and it just stays in Aramaic through the seventh chapter. So it appears that what happened is the author found a natural place to switch into Aramaic. And then, having switched into Aramaic, he just stays there. And as I pointed out in the first week, Aramaic was the lingua franca of the ancient world. Everybody who was involved in trade, in business, in politics, everybody was able to speak Aramaic. It was the language that everyone used. It seems to me that the sections in Daniel, this big section right here, starting in chapter 2, verse 4, and going through the end of chapter 7, that this section is more focused towards the Gentiles than the Jews. And therefore, it is switched into a language that is their the language that they use. When the audience is the primary audience is Jewish, it uses Hebrew. So the first chapter was kind of answering the question: so what all has changed now that we've been dragged off into exile? What all has changed with respect to our relationship to God? And chapter one answered that by saying, "I'm still here. I'm still listening to you. I'm still watching over you. And I'm going to bring you back." Then in the end of Daniel, 8 through the end of Daniel, again, it's the text is more focused on what does all of this have to do with Israel? What's the impact of this, what's been said, going to have on Israel? So it focuses back more on the Jews again. So as I understand it then, this section that we're beginning right here is the primary audience is Gentiles. It's talking about the phenomenon of empire. We'll talk more about that as the weeks go on. The first thing that these wise men say is, O king, live forever. That's probably a standard thing that they said. That's my assumption. But it's kind of ironic in this chapter, given that what we're going to see is one of the main points of the chapter, of the vision that Nebuchadnezzar received, was that empire is finite. Empire is only a flash in the pan from the perspective of infinity. And Nebuchadnezzar is going to die. He is mortal, and he too is just a flash in the pan. So it's ironic here, but what they're saying is, O king, live forever. What they say to Nebuchadnezzar then is they ask him, they've come to interpret the dream for him. They know that that's what Nebuchadnezzar's asking them to do. And they ask what is probably the standard thing to ask in this situation, and that is, tell us the dream. What was the dream? But Nebuchadnezzar's response is, no, I'm not telling you the dream. He had already decided for his own reasons, he had already decided, no, I'm not going to tell them the dream. I want to know that the interpretation that they give is one that is trustworthy, one that has its origins with the gods, with the divine. And so I am going to require that they tell me what the dream is, because it's only one who has access to the gods that's going to be able to tell what my dream was. So Nebuchadnezzar says, he had firmly decided, indicating he's not going to budge from that. They are going to have to tell him what the dream was. That's the only way he'll be able to trust the interpretation that they give. He goes further to say, if they don't do this, he's going to punish them. If they do it, they will be rewarded. The reward is gifts and honor. They'll probably be lavished upon them. The punishment is they will be chopped up, is what the NIV says. This section is in Aramaic. I'm not as familiar with Aramaic, nor even how to explore the meanings of Aramaic words very well. But it looks to me like it means limbed, that the limbs would be removed from their bodies. But I'm not certain that that's right. And their houses would be demolished. They'd be completely destroyed. By listing this as a punishment, it is so over the top that it's hard to know what to do with it. As we progress through the narrative, it seems to me that this over the topness becomes almost comic, and I'll talk about that at the end. Okay, so Nebuchadnezzar has established the requirement that they tell him what his dream was as a test to make sure that the interpretation is also divinely given. It is possible that Nebuchadnezzar also is suspicious of his wise men. As I pointed out, when a king comes to power, there are always people that are kind of maneuvering behind the scenes to see if there are weaknesses that they can take advantage of. And so it could very well be that Nebuchadnezzar is suspicious of his wise men and looking for indications that they are undermining his power. And that might be part of the insecurity that his troubled spirit that he's experiencing. The magicians come back and they repeat their request for Nebuchadnezzar to tell them the dream. I mean, it's just an unreasonable request from their perspective. They aren't trained to tell people what their dreams are. They're trained to interpret the dreams that people tell them. So they're incredulous that he is asking them to do the impossible. But Nebuchadnezzar doesn't back down. He doesn't buy this. He accuses them of stalling. He's thinking either they have special access to the thoughts of the gods or they don't. And if they do, then they should be able to tell him what his dream was. And it's only then that he can know that the dream interpretation is worth listening to. Now, why does he accuse them of lying and using corrupt words? I'm not sure, but he does suspect ill intent here, as I've indicated. And so it's possible that he's suspicious of their goodwill towards him. But to the reader, Nebuchadnezzar appears to be both arbitrary and unreasonable and even paranoid. And that's what we'll talk about at the end. The Chaldeans, the magicians, they respond. And Chaldeans, the term Chaldeans, it can either refer to the culture that dominated Babylon and became the ruling elite in Babylon during the Neo-Babylonian period, or it can be used more technically to mean these wise men. This group of wise men is sometimes referred to as the Chaldeans, and that's the term that's used when the text refers to the wise men as a group. That's the most likely term to be used in this chapter is Chaldeans. So the Chaldeans respond to Nebuchadnezzar and they say, "No one on earth can do this. What you're asking is impossible. No human being can do this. This is an absolutely unprecedented request. Only a god would be able to do this. And gods don't live among men." Which is a very interesting thing for them to claim, because there's a sense in which they were wrong, that throughout the history of Israel, in various ways, in various times, God did live among men. And I think back to going through Exodus. That was the key thing with the tabernacle. That was the key thing that Moses appealed to God for when they were at Mount Sinai, was that God be with them and be right in their midst. And the tabernacle was the means by which God was able to be right in their midst. The king became even more angry after the Chaldeans had responded to him and said, "This is impossible, only God can do this." And so he issued his decree that all of the wise men should be killed. And so messengers went out to collect all of the wise men, not just those that were there in the presence of the king at this time, but all of the wise men. And that even includes the trainees in the training program that Daniel and his friends are a part of. So someone goes to get Daniel and his friends along with all of the other wise men. So now Daniel comes into the action. Verses 14 through 16. When Arioch, the commander of the king's guard, had gone out to put to death the wise men of Babylon, Daniel spoke to him with wisdom and tact. He asked the king's officer, "Why did the king issue such a harsh decree?" Arioch then explained the matter to Daniel. At this, Daniel went to the king and asked for time so that he might interpret the dream for him. So this official comes, he's rounding up all of the wise men. He comes to Daniel, and he comes to get him, and he comes to get Daniel's three friends. Daniel is a cool customer here. He doesn't freak out. He doesn't get mad. He doesn't get scared. It says that Daniel spoke to him with wisdom and tact. And the first thing he does is he wants to find out what exactly is going on. And Arioch, the commander of the king's guard, who is the one who's been sent out to round up all of the wise men, he explains to him what it is, what's been going on, which is interesting. He's taking the time to give this explanation. So Arioch is at least to some degree sympathetic with Daniel. So Daniel, according to verse 13, he went to the king and asked for time. Now, I don't know if Daniel actually goes into the king's presence or whether he sends a message through Arioch. I don't know how best to understand this. If he does indeed go into the presence of the king, that's where I find it difficult to believe that Daniel would just be 15 years old and do that, and that the king would listen to him seriously. So maybe Daniel's older than that. Maybe it wasn't. Maybe the Babylonians didn't have the same practices as the Persians. Or it's possible that Daniel was 15 and had so much composure and a kind of air about him that was compelling to the king. It's possible. I don't know. I think it is interesting that he is an exile in Babylon. He is not a Babylonian. And if part of the king's concern, part of what he's worried about at this particular point in time, is whether he's got the full backing of people in his court, then he may be more willing to listen to a foreigner than a Babylonian in his court. There is precedence, I know, in history, for kings to want to have only foreigners as advisors, because they knew that anyone who had grown up in their culture would be likely to be attached to one faction or another in the political scene. Foreigners who are new to this culture are less likely to be aligned with any faction. So Daniel has an advantage here, in a sense, that Nebuchadnezzar is probably thinking, here is someone who's not politically aligned and therefore likely to be involved in any kind of conniving behind my back. Next section, verses 17 and 18. Then Daniel returned to his house and explained the matter to his friends Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. He urged them to plead for mercy from the God of heaven concerning this mystery, so that he and his friends might not be executed with the rest of the wise men of Babylon. So Daniel comes back to his house, to where he's living, and his three friends are apparently living there or right nearby, and he tells them what's going on. And obviously, this is of grave concern to all of them, because their lives are weighing in the balance here. So he asked them to plead for mercy from God. So he's asking them to pray and ask God to be merciful to them and spare them the fate that has been proclaimed for them by the king. The text refers to God as the God of heaven. In Daniel, in all of Daniel, with the exception of chapter 9, in all of the rest of Daniel, God is referred to by the term Elohim, or the Aramaic equivalent, or God of heaven, Elohim Shemayim, or the Elohe Shemayim, or the Aramaic equivalent. So it doesn't use Yahweh. Yahweh is only used in chapter 9, and we'll talk about that then. I think that's an interesting feature of chapter 9. which, by the way, is written in part of the section that's in Hebrew. So they are to pray that God will grant insight into what it was that Nebuchadnezzar dreamed, so that they'll be spared the fate of being put to death. 19 through 24. During the night, the mystery was revealed to Daniel in a vision. Then Daniel praised the God of heaven and said, "Praise be to the name of God forever and ever. Wisdom and power are his. He changes times and seasons. He sets up kings and deposes them. He gives wisdom to the wise and knowledge to the discerning. He reveals deep and hidden things. He knows what lies in darkness, and light dwells with him. I thank and praise you, O God of my fathers. You have given me wisdom and power. You have made known to me what we asked of you. You have made known to us the dream of the king." Then Daniel went to Arioch, whom the king had appointed to execute the wise men of Babylon, and said to him, "Do not execute the wise men of Babylon. Take me to the king, and I will interpret his dream for him." So Daniel and his friends had prayed to God that God would reveal to them the dream that Nebuchadnezzar had had. And God responded. It was in the night, in a vision, in a dream, the mystery, that is, what was the dream, that was revealed to Daniel. Daniel, in response, was ecstatic, and he burst into praise to God and gives this prayer to God. And he prays that God be blessed forever. Wisdom and power are his. So wisdom and power are things that are inherently God's. They are not. He portions those out to people as he sees fit. He controls the march of history. And I think that's what it means when it says he changes times and seasons. He sets up kings and he deposes them. He's the one that establishes the march of history, the periods of history, the rulers that control history. And he allots wisdom as to what will happen and why things happen. He reveals his purposes and his themes in history so that his people can understand why the things that are happening are happening. And he can do this because he understands both the darkness and the light. So he grants thanks and praise to God because God gave him some of that wisdom and power so that he would know the dream that Nebuchadnezzar had dreamed and that he could interpret it and that they could be spared. It is interesting that in the last part of his prayer, he says, "You have made known to me what we asked of you. You have made known to us the dream of the king." Why does he switch into the plural? I think it's because there's a sense in which this was granted to all four of them, to Daniel and his three friends. Daniel and his three friends were the ones who asked God for this understanding and wisdom, and God responded. The dream was given to Daniel directly, but indirectly it's to all four of them. They all four asked for it, and they all four benefit from it. So now Daniel can answer the king's questions. He communicates that to Arioch, and Arioch goes and takes that message to the king and stops the process of the execution of the wise men. Now, I doubt that any of the wise men were actually killed. I think it was probably put on hold, and here at this point, it's brought to a stop. It's interesting that Daniel ask for the decree that all of the wise men be killed, that was stopped, that he asked for that to be stopped. He wouldn't have had to ask for that. He could have allowed the rest of them, the other wise men, all to be killed. But I think Daniel saw that as an unreasonable punishment for the crime. And Daniel, to a certain extent, he's identifying with the wise men. They're the group that he's been put in with. And so this is a goodwill gesture towards them. And I think a very important goodwill gesture towards them. We'll see in subsequent chapters that goodwill gesture wasn't enough. We're going to see that there's hostility on the part of other of the wise men towards Daniel and his friends. And that'll crop up two or three times in the narrative as we progress. But this was a very important goodwill gesture towards them on the part of Daniel at this point. Daniel asked to see the king, and Arioch takes him to see the king, verses 25 through 30. Arioch took Daniel to the king at once and said, "I have found a man among the exiles from Judah who can tell the king what his dream means. The king asked Daniel, also called Belteshazzar, "Are you able to tell me what I saw in my dream and interpret it?" Daniel replied, "No wise man, enchanter, magician, or diviner can explain to the king the mystery he has asked about. But there is a God in heaven who reveals mysteries. He has shown King Nebuchadnezzar what will happen in days to come. Your dream and the visions that pass through your mind as you lay on your bed are these. As you were lying there, O king, your mind turned to things to come, and the revealer of mysteries showed you what is going to happen. As for me, this mystery has been revealed to me, not because I have greater wisdom than other living men, but so that you, O king, may know the interpretation, that you may understand what went through your mind." So Arioch introduces Daniel to the king, explains to him, this is one of the exiles from Judah that you brought back. And he is one who can tell you what your dream was, and he can interpret it to you. Now, it seems to me that Arioch is running a certain amount of risk by even making this option possible, making it possible for Daniel to give this presentation. But he seems to have faith in Daniel, and so he's willing to run that risk. But Daniel's going to have to come through. Arioch is kind of sticking his neck out. The king asks him, "Can you tell me what I dreamed and what it means?" And Daniel responds, "While it's true that none of your wise men could do this, it can be done. There is a God who knows what you dreamed, and he is a God who reveals mysteries, and he can reveal this mystery." And he prefaces it by saying, "Your dream was about the latter days." So this dream was about things that are going to happen in the future, which is exactly, I think, what Nebuchadnezzar was concerned about, what his worries, why he had a worried heart, because he wanted to know what was going to happen. And I think with respect to him and his empire specifically. And God revealed this dream to the king so that he could understand what it is that was going to come to pass. And he did this not to puff up, not to make Daniel look impressive, but because he wants that information to be conveyed to Nebuchadnezzar. The dream was about where history is going. So it's about the shape that history is going to take. And more specifically, what is the destiny of empire And I think that's what this vision is about, a key theme in the book of Daniel. And we'll go through the dream and the interpretation. Verses 31 through 35. You looked, O king, and there before you stood a large statue, an enormous, dazzling statue, awesome in appearance. The head of the statue was made of pure gold, its chest and arms of silver, its belly and thighs of bronze, its legs of iron, its feet partly of iron and partly of baked clay. While you were watching, a rock was cut out, but not by human hands. It struck the statue on its feet of iron and clay and smashed them. Then the iron, the clay, the bronze, the silver, and the gold were broken to pieces at the same time and became like chaff on a threshing floor in the summer. The wind swept them away without leaving a trace. But the rock that struck the statue became a huge mountain and filled the whole earth. So the vision is of this one large statue, a statue of a man-like figure. It's full of splendor, and I assume that it's just gleaming. It's made of, especially the upper part of the body of this statue is of metals, precious metals, and I would assume that it's just gleaming. The head is gold, the breast is silver, the belly and the thighs are bronze, and the legs are iron, and then it gets more specific. As you go down the legs to the feet, they are iron and baked clay, or porcelain. Then it switches, and it talks about this stone that's cut out. I assume cut out of some kind of rock outcropping. It's cut out, but it says specifically, but not by the hands of man, not by human hands. And this rock that is cut out of a cliff or whatever, it strikes the statue in the feet. So the feet seem to be a vulnerable point, and the whole thing comes crashing down. And in reading this, it reminds me of the Twin Towers in 9/11, when the airplane hits the tower and the building just comes down in a pile of dust. Well, that's the similar kind of thing happened with this statue in Nebuchadnezzar's dream. The whole thing comes down, is reduced to just dust after having been struck on the feet. And it's all gone, it all blows away. And the stone that struck the feet, it becomes a mountain. So it grows, it becomes a mountain, and it fills the whole earth. Now, Daniel, that was the dream. That's what Nebuchadnezzar saw. And Nebuchadnezzar would know, yes, that's what I saw. Now he gives an interpretation of that dream. 36 through 43. This was the dream and how we will interpret it to the king. And now we will interpret it to the king. You, O king, are the king of kings. The God of heaven has given you dominion and power and might and glory. In your hands he has placed mankind and the beasts of the field and the birds of the air. Wherever they live, he has made you ruler over them all. You are that head of gold. After you, another kingdom will rise, inferior to yours. Next, a third kingdom, one of bronze, will rule over the whole earth. Finally, there will be a fourth kingdom, strong as iron, for iron breaks and smashes everything. And as iron breaks things to pieces, so it will crush and break all the others. Just as you saw that the feet and toes were partly of baked clay and partly of iron, so this will be a divided kingdom. Yet it will have some of the strength of iron in it, even as you saw iron mixed with clay. As the toes were partly iron and partly clay, so this kingdom will be partly strong and partly brittle. And just as you saw the iron mixed with baked clay, so the people will be a mixture and will not remain united any more than iron mixes with clay. It's interesting that again, Daniel says, this was the dream, and now we, in the plural, will interpret it to the king. I assume, once again, he's using the plural because there's a sense in which his friends are a party to what he is saying to the king. The interpretation of the dream is that it starts out with Nebuchadnezzar being the king of kings. Nebuchadnezzar is the one to whom God has given power, and he has given power to him to rule over the whole world, over man and beast in that world. So he's got dominion over everything, which is quite a statement to say, and I'm sure that that pleased Nebuchadnezzar. And then he says, the head of gold represent, you are the head of gold. Silver represents the next kingdom. And then it says specifically, it is inferior to the first. Doesn't tell us anything more. Then comes bronze. Doesn't tell us anything more. Then iron. And there are two things that are emphasized with respect to this part of the statue. It's iron, so it's strong. And it breaks things in pieces. The other thing is that it is uncohesive. So this is the first, at least in the feet, this is the first part of the statue where it is said that it's uncohesive. And no other part of the statue does it say that that's the case. It is iron mixed with baked clay. Some of it's strong, some of it's brittle, but most importantly, it's not cohesive. It doesn't hold together. Suggesting that society is one that in which people are mixed together and it lacks social cohesion for some reason. And that's going to be its Achilles heel, pun only slightly intended. But that is, it's that lack of cohesion then that when it is struck and the whole thing comes down. Next section, 44 and 45. In the time of those kings, the God of heaven will set up a kingdom that will never be destroyed, nor will it be left to another people. It will crush all those kingdoms and bring them to an end, but it will itself endure forever. This is the meaning of the vision of the rock cut out of a mountain, but not by human hands. A rock that broke the iron, the bronze, the clay, the silver, and the gold to pieces. The great God has shown the king what will take place in the future. The dream is true and the interpretation is trustworthy. So here then, at the end of human history, God is going to set up an eternal kingdom. So it will stop the evolution of empire. The statue, as I'm going to argue in just a minute, represents the evolution of human empire. But this kingdom, it will stop that evolution. There will no longer be evolution of empire. This kingdom will not be the work of human hands. So empire will come to a complete end. It will all be destroyed. The whole effort of empire building will be brought to nothing. But God's kingdom, the eternal kingdom, will replace it, and it will be forever. And it will be a different thing. It will be qualitatively different. It is the sovereign God, the great God, it says, and that's the other God of heaven and great God are the two terms that are used in most of Daniel to refer to God, to refer to Yahweh. Yahweh, the God of gods, is the one who has revealed this, and therefore it is true and trustworthy. You can count on it, as the juvenile delinquents that I worked with when I was really young used to say, you can take that to the bank. Verses 46 through 49. Then King Nebuchadnezzar fell prostrate before Daniel and paid him honor and ordered that an offering and incense be presented to him. The king said to Daniel, "Surely your God is the God of gods and the Lord of kings and a revealer of mysteries, for you were able to reveal this mystery." Then the king placed Daniel in a high position and lavished many gifts on him. He made him ruler over the entire province of Babylon and placed him in charge of all its wise men. Moreover, at Daniel's request, the king appointed Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego administrators over the province of Babylon, while Daniel himself remained at the royal court. So Nebuchadnezzar bows down to Daniel and even says that offerings and incense are to be offered to Daniel. And all of this is done out of respect for the God that Daniel represents. That is, out of respect for Yahweh, who he calls the God of gods. This is quite a reversal of what from what would be expected. What would be expected would be Daniel would bow down before Nebuchadnezzar. But now Nebuchadnezzar is bowing down before Daniel as a representative of the God of gods. So at this point, Nebuchadnezzar is recognizing that Yahweh is the God of gods, the Lord of kings, and the revealer of mysteries. And then it talks about this, the status that Daniel is granted, Daniel and his friends. I really think that this is talking about events that happen after the training has been completed. So it's probably another 2 years before this part is actually realized. I assume that's the case. That would make the most sense. It was at Daniel's request that his friends were placed in high positions in the administration of the province of Babylon, which was a great thing for him to do, to make sure that they were honored for their part in this as well. Now, Nebuchadnezzar's response that Yahweh is the God of gods, the Lord of kings, the revealer of mysteries, that doesn't seem to be indicative of an enduring interest in Yahweh. We'll see in the next chapter that that doesn't seem to be his continued perspective. So I think the way that we're supposed to understand this is Nebuchadnezzar was very excited about getting his dream interpreted. And he may think that this God of Daniel is noteworthy, but I think it's pretty clear he's not convinced that Yahweh is truly the God of gods, the one true God. So his response is kind of like, cool, yeah, that's cool, but it doesn't go any deeper than that. But there are indications, it seems to me, and we'll talk about this next week, that he did really reflect on this dream, and he does draw some conclusions about how he needs to proceed on the basis of this dream. He just draws the wrong conclusions. Okay, so that's the interpretation that Daniel gave. Unfortunately, that interpretation is not very complete. The dream contains more content than Daniel laid out there. So I'm going to go through and see if I can present what I think is an interpretation of the interpretation that Daniel gave. Daniel leaves many details that go unexplained. And I'm convinced those details are important. They're there for a reason. And I'm going to go through and try to make sense of some of those details. Daniel's interpretation cries out for elucidation, it seems to me. And his interpretation only points us in a direction. There's a lot more that needs to be figured out. Let me start by making some observations about the dream, and then I'm going to build on those observations. The first thing to note is that the metals that constitute this statue are in a specific order. And that order, I think, is very important. The order suggests, as I mentioned before, evolution that occurs over time. Starting from the top, starting from the gold head that represents Nebuchadnezzar and the Babylonian Empire, and working down, it progresses in time. So the bottom is the closest to the end of history. As you go down the statue, it is obvious that the metals are less precious as you go down. The most precious is the head, but then we move to silver, and we move to bronze, then we move to iron, and then we move the mixture of iron and porcelain. So they become less precious as you go down. They also become harder as you go down. I don't know about the relative hardness of silver and gold, but I'm assuming that silver is a little harder than gold. Bronze is definitely harder than silver or gold, and iron is definitely harder than the others. The other thing that is significant as you go down the statue is that they are all produced by human labor. That could be just coincidence, but I don't think so, because when it talks about the rock that destroys the statue, it says it was cut out of a cliff or whatever, but not by human hands. So it draws attention to human activity in each of these metals. And gold and silver have to be refined. They have to be purified in order to be useful the way that they've been used historically. I don't know enough about the gold and silver to know for sure that silver is harder to process than gold. But as we move to bronze, that is clearly a more difficult process that one has to go through in order to make bronze. Bronze is a combination of copper and tin, as I recall. It has to be mixed in just the right way in order to get that strong metal bronze. And then iron is an even more difficult thing to produce. And it was much later in history that mankind discovered the secret of how to create iron. And then those people, wherever that was discovered, they kept it secret for a long time because they didn't want the surrounding peoples to be able to make iron because they knew it was kind of a secret weapon. So the metals, as you work down, require more human processing. And even the porcelain at the end, that's baked clay, but baked in a special way that makes it useful for human beings. And typically it's pots that have to be manufactured that's mixed in with the iron. As I mentioned before, the metals are apparently arranged in chronological order, going from the earliest to the end of history. So it starts with the time of Nebuchadnezzar at the gold head, and it ends with the feet, which I take to be the end of human history. The feet support the statue. The feet are, in a sense, the telos of empire. It's what all of the rest of the statue was working toward. It was the natural outcome of empire. And it points out that iron is the hardest material, which crushes and shatters all things. The other thing of note is that the feet are not cohesive. They don't hang together. The text makes it really clear that that is significant. And that's what makes the feet particularly vulnerable. I don't know what the lack of cohesion stands for, as I mentioned before. I don't know whether it's different ethnicities, whether it's different cultures, whether it's different interest groups. Whatever it is, we have a kingdom, an empire, in which the different peoples just are not united. There isn't the kind of social cohesion that were present in the other parts of the statue. And all of this comes down because of a different kingdom, which didn't arise from this process of evolution. It has a completely different origin. It is not a human construct. It is eternal rather than a flash in the pan. And it will never be displaced. The statement that where it says you, talking to Nebuchadnezzar, you are that head of gold, it helps us to understand what kind of thing the metals stand for. So the metals seem to stand for that which Nebuchadnezzar has, empire. And I'll point out in the Old Testament, the distinction between king and his empire, or king and his kingdom, is often blurred. The two are seen as being really closely tied, and therefore you can refer to one or the other and go back and forth. But the head stands for either Nebuchadnezzar or a Babylonian empire. So the metals seem to be empires that chronologically come after the Babylonian empire. So the statue is showing the evolution of empire. What is the dream saying? It seems to me that this dream is dealing with what I call the trajectory of empire. It's telling us what the trajectory is, what's going to happen over time to empire, and where it's going, what it's culmination is going to be, what its telos is going to be. I really think that it's important to see it that way rather than see it as telling us about individual empires or kingdoms. Its focus is on what is the nature of this thing that Babylon is the start of. What is the nature of this thing that's going to grow and develop and change over time? And what are the kinds of changes that are going to happen to this thing? Now, this vision is fundamental to the book of Daniel, and it's going to be built on. And in other parts of Daniel, it seems to me that it actually associates names of kingdoms or empires to some of the, that could be attached to some of the pieces of this statue. So it's not like that's not present at all. But in this chapter, the emphasis, I think, is on that whole evolutionary trajectory. And what is the nature of that trajectory? One is it's going to, over time, empire is going to become less precious. And I'm using the term precious because I don't know exactly what that symbolizes. But it's going to be less precious. And that's really clear from the text itself. It says that the second is inferior to the first. Inferior in what sense? And it doesn't tell us. But empires become bigger. They become more powerful. There are all kinds of ways in which they are better. But from the perspective of Daniel 2, they become inferior as you go down the statue. My guess with respect to preciousness is that what's being talked about is less humane. I don't know that that's true. There might be a better understanding of what precious stands for, but my best guess is that they become less humane. And I could go into an argument for why I think that's could be true of Babylon, that Babylon was a more humane empire than say the Roman Empire or something else, but I won't take the time to do that right now. I assume that they will become more harsh, that that's what it means by when we move down, it gets to iron, and iron is hard and it crushes everything, that it will be more harsh. It will become more artificial. And I think that's what it means by being increasingly the product of human hands. That this, in some sense, it becomes more artificial, more divorced from reality, more divorced from the world that God created us as human beings to be in. And at the end, it will be less united. It's not, the vision doesn't seem to indicate that it will become less cohesive over time. It's only at the end that it loses cohesion. And I think that's significant. This whole thing, and it's seeing it all as one thing, empire. It's seeing it as one thing. Although it changes over time, it's all headed towards its telos at the feet. So it's one thing, and it's all going to come down in an instant. The whole enterprise of uniting people to do godlike things will be destroyed and come to nothing. Now, when I say the whole enterprise of uniting people to do godlike things, I'm reflecting back on Babylon, on the Tower of Babel, which I think is a precursor, and a precursor that has been pointed out by the author of Daniel. It is a precursor to this whole development, and it kind of encapsulates what empire is all about. This whole human project is just a flash in the pan. And it will be replaced by an eternal kingdom, which will be of divine origin, something that is fundamentally different from empire. Okay, what should Nebuchadnezzar learn from this? He can rest assured that he is ruling over the most precious empire in history. He should be flattered by what he's been told. It is united, and it is the least artificial of any of the stages of empire. But the dream is also saying he would be foolish to invest himself fully in empire. It is just a fleeting phenomenon. It will not last. And therefore, Nebuchadnezzar should seek citizenship in the eternal kingdom. Any wise person, having heard what Daniel has said, would conclude that that is the position that any human being should take. That's the response of any human being who's got wisdom. What can we as readers of this text, chapter 2 of Daniel, learn? And I think that it's similar. They go through a process of devolution, not evolution. In our day and age, it is generally thought that we keep progressing. Things keep getting better. That is a modern notion. Before the Enlightenment, the perspective that goes way back into ancient times, we know this from Greek literature and elsewhere, they thought that over time, human culture degrades, and that it was much better before the writers in ancient times were writing. It'd be much better before historic times. It is only since the Enlightenment that we have turned that on our on its heads, and we see things as improving, progress. Progress just keeps happening and will keep happening. We always progress. And this is what historians call the Whiggish view of history, that things will just keep getting better and human institutions will keep improving and et cetera, et cetera. But that's not the perspective of this vision. This vision is not one of evolution and progress, but rather it's devolution and regression. Empires will become less precious, and if I'm right associating that with humaneness, then they'll become more brutal. They'll become harder. And at the end of time, empires will be less unified, which is very interesting, especially if we reflect back on the Tower of Babel. If you recall, God's way of dealing with and judging the Tower of Babel to make sure that they were not able to achieve their grandiose ideas, their godlike visions of what they would achieve, God's way of dealing with that was to confuse their language so they couldn't talk to one another, to break up that unity, the unity which made it possible for them to do amazing things. And that's in history, we've seen human beings achieve truly amazing things, truly things that border on godlike. It is astounding. But what God is going to do with respect to human history as a whole, to empire in human history, is the same thing that he did with the Tower of Babel. He's going to exploit the fact that there is no true unity there and release, unveil that chaos, and the whole thing is going to come crashing down. Therefore, we should invest in that which is eternal and not in that which is short-lived. Okay, I just have a few comments as a conclusion, and then I'll be done. The way that this story is presented is like a cartoon. If I had artistic ability, I think it'd be fun to make an animated cartoon of this story. The story is similar to the story of Joseph being in Egypt. And when Pharaoh had a dream and nobody could interpret the dream, Joseph was brought in and he was able to interpret it. But here in Daniel, things are a little bit bigger, a little more difficult. For instance, Daniel has to tell Nebuchadnezzar what the dream was, as opposed to what happened with Joseph. He didn't have to tell Pharaoh what the dream was. And the penalty for failure is death, and that was not made explicit in Genesis, the story of Joseph. But the story is cartoon-like. The astrologers come in, and they're like kind of like buffoons. If I could draw it, I'd draw. They'd have long sleeves that are too long, and they come stumbling in, kind of like the seven dwarves. And Nebuchadnezzar is kind of like the Queen of Hearts in Alice in Wonderland. Off with their heads! Off with their heads! It's overdone. I think that's an interesting feature of the presentation. The second thing, God is not as negative towards empire as I would have expected. He doesn't go out of his way here to take jabs at empire itself and talk about what a horrible thing empire is. Nebuchadnezzar is not really depicted all that negatively here or in the rest of Daniel as we progress. In fact, I'm going to argue that the overall presentation of Nebuchadnezzar is pretty sympathetic. It's a mixed bag, but all in all, of Nebuchadnezzar is sympathetic. And we see the officials in the empire are sympathetic characters. We have Arioch here. We had can't remember who the name of the guy in chapter one, but we've got Arioch, the palace official, and then the guard, three officials that are all presented as being pretty sympathetic towards Daniel, and they're the ones that make it possible for Daniel to do what he is doing. And so there's a sense in which these officials are able to take the edge off of empire. And so empire as a whole is not all that grotesque as it's presented in Daniel. The last thing I want to point out is that, next to last thing I want to point out is that empire is steeped in insecurity and hubris. As I argued when we talked about the Tower of Babel, that the Tower of Babel was born out of insecurity. Babel, the tower, the city was all built as defensive fortifications in order to protect the wealth that the Babylonians had created. And they created that wealth because their lives were precarious. Just finding enough food to live on was a difficult chore. So they started agriculture, and they were successful in agriculture. They stored their food. They traded their food for other goods. They became wealthy as a result of starting agriculture. And then they needed something to defend their wealth. And that was the Tower of Babel and the city. So empire was born out of insecurity. And even the all-powerful ruler is insecure, because his hold on power is tenuous. And this becomes even more true since in subsequent history, and in specific with respect to monarchies. Because, as Hannah Arendt points out in one of her books, that we have created this problem, especially in Western culture, we've created this problem that didn't exist before when there were monarchies. In monarchies, there was the concept of a divine right of kings, that kings ruled because God gave them authority to do so. But when we did away with monarchy, we replaced that with republics or constitutional monarchies or whatever. But the question then arises, who gives the person who is calling the shots the power to do what he's doing? As a result, rulers since the demise of monarchy are even more insecure than were those earlier. As a result then, as a result of this insecurity, especially on the part of the ruling group, the society has to be held together, and it has to be held together by force. And that's what is always resorted to. So any challenge to authority is seen as a threat, an existential threat to the power structure, and it has to be stamped out so that it doesn't spread and grow. So the solution to any problem that exists in a society is to crank up the force. The other is hubris. It seems like the one who is in command has such vast resources that he should be able to do anything. And that's what develops in these empires. Rulers with this great power, they tend to believe that they should be able to do anything. And if they can't, then they aren't getting the cooperation that they deserve. They should have. Lastly, we must not be fooled about the power of empire. Empire looks like it's unassailable, but that's an illusion. At a point in time, empire can look absolutely invincible. It looks like there's nothing that we can do to stand in its way, but it isn't. And that's the most important point of this vision. As we'll see, and as we see in Revelation, the book of Revelation, at the end of time and the end of history, the power of the state is going to appear to be absolutely overwhelming. But the thing that Revelation keeps reminding of us of is that it will only have power for a moment in time. It's a very fleeting time period when it has power. Unfortunately, it's probably longer than we would like, but historically speaking, and certainly from the perspective of eternity, it's just a fleeting time. And even during that fleeting time, when the power of empire is absolutely overwhelming, God will be in control. And nothing will be happening that is out of God's control. He knows what he's doing, and he's taking care of his people. Okay, that's all I had on chapter 2 of Daniel. I don't see any questions. Thank you very much for your attention. And next week we'll move on to chapter 3. Thanks. Bye.